The crash of the fallen roof had not startled Bird Eisen. He sat on the sofa on the dead, outstretched legs of Sheriff Harriet Sweet and stared blankly up and around at the fiery mass surrounding him. He held his breath the same way he'd learned to hold his breath all of his life when things roared or crashed or grew too hot around him. He wasn't hiding from the deputies. In fact, he'd had no idea they might be waiting out there to see if he would flee from the burning building. He liked sitting inside a fire and watching it bluster and rage. He hadn't given a thought to the deputies or to anything else since finishing his gruesome task on Cleveland Phelps. He'd kept the knife in his blood-soaked hand and simply rolled under the bed and lain there, staring at the bottom of the feather mattress and feeling the skin on his wrist and hand draw tight as Phelps's blood dried there. With the knife still in his hand, he felt the heat and smoke cause his eyes to water, tears drying down his scorching cheeks. He knew it was almost time to go. Almost, but not quite. He timed it in his mind, feeling the heat and forcing himself to stand it. The hair atop his head singed down to his skull. He raised his free hand and patted out the sparks from a stray ember. Short pieces of timber fell around him, and he ducked slightly to one side. His lungs throbbed in his chest until he knew he was losing consciousness. As Bert grew weaker, he dropped to the floor, to where he knew he could always find a thin layer of air. Then he crawled fast like a tortured snake, coming to his feet through a wall of flames and throwing himself through the thickest part of it.
Did you hear that?
I heard something. I don't know what.
Hart studied the rising black smoke above the jagged wall of rock.
Maybe we better go back.
It's up to you. But there's no one alive back there, if that's what you're thinking. If there was anything to it, we'd have heard more by now.
You're right. I'm anxious to get back to Fort Smith. Sim said he'd take J.T. Priest into custody. Let's hope he does. With any luck, Sims will have Priest hog-tied before they're halfway across the flatlands. If he doesn't, we'll be right back on the trail.
Wouldn't surprise me if Sims had him in custody already. Sims doesn't know it, but he's turning into quite a lawman. He's a devil to work with, but you gotta give that devil his due.
In the snow out front of the collapsed hotel, Bird Eisen rolled back and forth. Steam rose from him as he rolled farther away from the searing heat. At length, he lay flat in the snow. The bloody knife was still in his hand. He pitched himself up onto his knees, rubbed snow on his face, then stood up and started walking. His shirt nearly turned to ashes, the holes burned in his trousers exposing split and blackened skin underneath. He walked across the deep, snow-filled footbridge, feeling the iced contraption sag under his feet. On the other side of the bridge, he walked on, through a make-believe world where all signs of man had been covered beneath a thick, white blanket of snow. When Bert rounded a sharp turn in the trail that led upward toward the mining yards, three old Indians on horseback drew up quickly at the sight of him. Eisen would have walked right through these vaporous apparitions had it not been for one of them sidling his horse against him. The two other horses drew close around him, the riders looking down bewildered, and then looking at one another with curious detachment as Bert's feet still tried to walk, although he laid on his side in the clinging snow.
You, Bert's man, what are you doing up here?
When Bert only rose to his knees with the bloody knife in his hand and stared up at him, one of the others jumped his horse a step closer and aimed an old flintlock rifle down at his face.
What do we care what he's doing up here? You see the knife, the blood?
Well, that doesn't mean he killed Crow Striker. Don't be foolish. Would he be carrying the knife around this long? Could he be out in the cold?
No, but this is a sign, Henri Kettle.
It's not a sign.
All three of the Indians looked off at the dark, boiling rise of smoke.
This poor child did not kill Cross Striker. Can't you see it in his eyes? He could kill no one. We come to take vengeance for Cross Striker. It does him no honor if we kill the wrong man. Bring him. He will tell us something.
A second passed as Henri rode slowly forward. When he heard no horses behind him, he stopped and looked back.
Well?
The other two were where he'd left them.
He does not come. I have poked him and poked him. Still, he sits there. I think he has no mind, this one.
Henri Kettle turned his horse and heeled it back through the snow.
I think the one with no mind is the one who does the poking.
The three had spent the night before in a small cave, their old bones aching from the cold. They had been cross and testy with one another all day. Henri Kettle swung his tired body down off the blanket and pelt-covered saddle and stood looking at Bert Eisen, taking little heed of the knife in Bert's hand.
You are burned from head to toe. Were you with the men who hung Kroll Striker up there?
Bert Eisen only leered at him.
See, I told you, Red Horse. He did not do it.
He did not answer you at all. How can you say he did not do it?
Because some things I can't tell. This boy is no killer. If you had grown wiser over the years, as all good men do, you would see it too.
What is that supposed to mean?
The third Indian watched his aged friends bicker back and forth for a moment.
It is too cold to sit here and argue. Ask him to come with us, Henri Kettle. Perhaps he feels better when he is not being poked with a rifle.
Come with us, Burnt Man.
Henri Kettle reached an aged hand out to Bert Eisen as if to help him stand. But Bert shot to his feet. He slashed the knife at Henri Kettle's hand, barely missing it. Henri Kettle jerked his hand back and examined it.
Let me shoot him, Henri Kettle.
Silence, Red Horse.
Henri Kettle reached his hand out again toward Bert Eisen, this time slower.
Come with us. You are cold and in much pain. We will find some clothes and a coat for you. We will make a salve for your burns.
Bert Eisen held that knife poised for another swipe. But when Henri Kettle neither backed away nor tried moving closer, Bert settled down.
See? I won't hurt you. Neither will he.
Henri Kettle nodded at Red Horse.
He just wants to talk bold to you, to make you think he is not afraid. Isn't that right, Red Horse?
Yes, this is true. Come along with us. I will not hurt you, Burnt Man.
It had been slow going down the mountain in the service engine for the first few miles as it chugged backward against the heavy snow. But once Merle Jones reached an old siding rail leading back to an abandoned mine, he backed the engine onto it, turned it around, and came out forward onto the tracks, the cattle snatcher serving as a snow blade. The rest of the trip had taken all night through the falling snow. Louisville Ike and Dirk LeMaster having to get out twice in the bitter cold to clear high drifts out of their way. By the time Jones rolled that engine into the depot, his eyes were red-rimmed and his hand was shaky and tired on the throttle.
Well, it's been a rough one, gentlemen.
There's an extra $300 in it for you if you take us on across the flatland.
You've got to be kidding me. I wouldn't go another mile for all the money in the...
His words cut short when he felt the barrel of J.T. Priest's pistol jam into his belly.
It's illegal forcing me against my will this way.
Haven't you been paying attention, railroad man? I'm on the run from the law now for murder and jailbreak. You think putting a bullet through you is gonna make me any difference one way or the other?
300, you said?
Make it 5. Now back this sucker into Harrington's Pullman car and let's get moving.
Within minutes, Louisville Ike and LeMaster had loaded coal, and Jones had taken on water from the tank inside the service shed. The storm wind had left the depot and service shed ravaged. The railroad workers had all gone 3 miles north up the flatland rails to clear a heavy rock slide. An elderly station attendant came forward toward the tracks as Jones backed the engine in and coupled it to the Pullman car.
You can't take that engine out of here, Jones. You've been gone too long as it is.
Just watch us!
Still, the attendant persisted, ducking his head and jumping back a step.
You leave that Pullman car where it sits. It was stolen from C.B. Harrington. He's coming for it.
I am C.B. Harrington, you meddling old fool.
This time, not wanting to push his luck, the attendant scurried away, slipping sideways back to the shelter of a storm-torn work shack. Jones pushed the throttle, and the train quickly gained speed. An hour later, Quick Charlie Sims turned his face from the Pullman car window and looked straight into C.B. Harrington's malevolent eyes.
Never thought we'd make it down the mountain, did you, Sims? Whatever plan you had involved the two deputies catching up to us, eh?
Sims slumped on the wooden bench, Kate McCorkle beside him. The two of them facing J.T. Priest and C.B. Harrington, sitting on a plush sofa. LeMaster stood at the bar on the other side of a card table, the same table where Sims had made a fool of him and exposed him and Louisville Ike as card cheats. Ike was in the engine, keeping an eye on Jones.
If that was my plan, you've got it screwed up tight, Harrington.
Sims looked down at his bound wrists and tapped the tips of his fingers together.
Suppose there'd be no harm now in cutting us loose, letting us finish this trip in comfort.
Not a chance in hell, Sims. I'm watching every move you make, every flicker of an eyelid. I know you too well. First I let your hands loose, then you ask for something more. Pretty soon we're having to deal with you all over again.
Careful you don't watch me so close that you forget to keep an eye on old CB here. He's the one about to clean your clock. Isn't that right, CB?
Come now, JT. I think you give this man too much credit. So far, he hasn't showed me much. He got the drop on Radnor and me. But thinking back on it, I believe that was merely a stroke of luck.
Oh, really? Well, then why not be a sport? Cut us loose. I promise I won't try anything, and neither will she. Right, Kate?
Kate nodded slowly, her eyes fixed coldly on J.T. Priest.
That's right. Cut us loose, you low, dirty son of a bitch. See if I don't rip your lousy eyes out of your head.
Kate!
My, I was seriously considering it. But that would have been a bad idea.
Harrington settled back into the sofa, crossed one knee over the other, and studied Sims and Kate with curiosity as the Pullman car rolled along. Then he looked at J.T. Priest and propped an arm up along the back of the sofa.
J.T., I look at the three of you and can't help but wonder what twist of circumstances ever brought you together.
This worm framed Charlie for bank robbery. Then while Charlie was in jail for it...
Take it easy, Kate. That's all water under the bridge. Don't give him the satisfaction. It's the only good scheme he ever pulled off in his life.
Ha! Good scheme? Let me tell you both something. I set you both up like 10 ducks in a shooting gallery. Yeah, I put this fool on the run for a bank me and my boys robbed. And her? When the law held her for questioning about his whereabouts, I stepped in, bailed her out, and cleared her name. She followed me around like a lapdog until he skipped jail and showed up again.
Kate sprang forward, but Sims caught her arm with his bound hands and pulled her back.
You liar!
Kate, for crying out loud!
Fascinating. This life you lived as the gang leader of Los Pistoleros, it must have been extremely interesting.
Oh, yes. I have to admit, nobody ran an operation the way I ran mine.
He's lying. He was never more than the second in command. He was more like a bag man for William Mowbray. Started out pushing stolen cattle for Mowbray, then he became a hired gun and did some killing for him. Later, Mowbray kept him on, probably to keep him from starving to death. Mowbray fed him the scraps, kept the big money for himself.
Why, you bastard!
Priest's pistol streaked from his holster. C.B. Harrington jumped up from the sofa. He waved a thick hand at LeMaster, hurrying him over. LeMaster bounded across the card table, looking scared, his pistol wavering in his shaky hand.
I bet you won't shoot me, Priest. I bet Harrington won't let you. Will you, Harrington?
Not ever, everybody, calm down. JT, please, lower that pistol. We have too much at stake here. Don't let Sims rattle you now. Use your head, man. You're almost home on this deal.
All right.
Harrington settled back onto the sofa.
My goodness. Perhaps we shouldn't engage in any more conversation.
Ah, you're right, Harrington. Maybe we'd better not talk anymore. I might slip and tell you something about Mowbray and Priest. It would change the whole flavor of this deal you got cooked up.
Don't even start, Sims. Neither CB nor I are buying your bill of goods.
Oh, I wouldn't be selling this bill of goods. This one I'll be giving away.
What's he talking about, JT?
Who knows? He'll say anything he can think of right about now. He knows I'm gonna kill him once this is over. Hurt too. You see, CB, Sims tried to imply a moment ago that you're the one I need to watch. Now he's wanting to tell you that I'm up to something. He knows he's played out his hand. Now he's desperate.
Oh, yes, of course. We'll just let him rant if he needs to. It's entertaining, to say the least.
They rode in silence for the next 15 or 20 minutes. But finally, Harrington's curiosity got the better of him.
Let me ask you one more thing, Sims. You had what you wanted. You got yourself clear to the robbery. You got your woman back, and a nice chunk of stock in Midwest Investment. Why didn't you leave well enough alone? Why the vengeance?
For the gold, of course. The same thing you're really after.
Gold?
What gold?
Oh, don't play dumb, Harrington. The gold you told me about before I threw you and Radnor off the train. The gold Priest hid in the caves over in the Badlands years ago.
You're out of your mind! We never talked about any gold. He's lying, JT.
He knows about the gold, Priest. The gold you hid for Mowbray. The gold in the false bottom of those wagons you stashed after killing the gypsies. Oh, come on, JT. Harrington knows about it, you know about it, and I know about it. Why else would I be chasing your worthless hide all over the country?
JT Priest turned a puzzled look at Harrington. But Harrington only shrugged.
Believe me, I have no idea in the world what he's talking about.
J.T. Priest then turned his lost gaze to Sims, his mouth slightly agape. He studied Sims' eyes.
The gold, Priest! It was Confederate gold being shipped out of the country. The gypsies were only a ruse. They were working for the Confederate States of America. Don't act like you don't know about it.
Priest only stared, dumbstruck.
Oh, my goodness. You really don't know about it, do you?
J.T. Priest shook his head slowly, his eyes locked on Sims.
What gold?
The gypsies. Well, you remember the gypsies.
Priest only nodded, confounded by this sudden revelation of something so long ago.
What gold?
There were false beds in their wagons, Priest. They had a lot of gold in those wagons. You mean to tell me you had no idea that you never even searched the wagons?
J.T. Priest gave no response, still totally stunned at the prospect of having had riches at his fingertips and never knowing it.
What? Gold!
Harrington shot from the chair, flailing his big arms in the air, standing now, his pistol butt dangerously close to Kate McCorkle's bound hands.
Jesus. I know Mowbray didn't know about it, but I thought for sure you did. There was close to $4 million in gold in those wagons. All the money the Confederate Army had. Well, most of those gypsies were actually Confederate soldiers guarding the shipment.
Now hold it! You say gold? Confederate gold? $4 million? That, There wasn't that much gold in a hole.
Then why are you after it, Harrington?
Don't listen to this man, JT. You just said yourself he'd try anything, didn't you?
Yes, I know.
Listen to me, Sims. It's obvious what you're doing. I won't have it. Open your mouth again, I'll have LeMaster put a bullet in it. You're not going to ruin what I've got going here. For JT and myself.
All right. Forget it, Priest. He's right. It was only a scheme I came up with at the last minute. I gotta use the Jake. Can LeMaster take me?
Me too. Really bad.
Damn it. LeMaster, take them both.
Harrington gestured a hand toward a small door near the back of the car.
Take her there. Walk him out back on the platform. Watch him close.
Harrington turned to Cade McCorkle.
Young lady, if you stick your head out that door before LeMaster comes back for you, I'll have J.T. Priest shoot you. Are we clear on this?
Cade only nodded, she and Sims rising at the same time, LeMaster keeping a safe step back from him with his hand on his pistol butt. Harrington stood watching him until Cade McCorkle stepped inside the small room, and LeMaster shoved Sims forward and out onto the rear platform.
Now then, what is all this about gold, sir? And need I remind you, we're about to become partners in a tremendous business undertaking.
I don't know. There was a time up on the Badlands, some gypsies Marbury and his boys killed. That much is true. I went back later on and took their bodies, wagons and all, into a cave. But this other thing about Confederate gold, I have no idea what he's talking about.
If it's about a missing shipment of gold from Atlanta, I know a lot about it. I had investments in the South. I lost a ton of money in that blasted war. There was talk about a large shipment of gold being smuggled out of the country for safekeeping. It was never heard of again. Some say it may have cost the South the war. If you know anything about it, I suggest you tell me, sir. No, I demand you tell me. If you expect us to go through with our deal as planned.
Well, he said you were after the gold all along. Is that true?
No. He's lying through his teeth. But apparently there's some truth to what he's talking about. Why else would he be chasing you all over the land? Like I said earlier, he's already got what he set after. He's free, and you're running from the law. If you know where there's $4 million in gold hidden out there, we need to go see about it, don't you think? Partner?
This could all be a trick of some sort. I don't trust anything Quick Charlie says.
What possible trick could there be to this? He knows he's a dead man once we settle this deal.
I don't know. But I don't trust it. Not as long as Sims is alive. There's no way I'd head out for the Badlands with him around.
On the rear deck, Sims straightened his trousers and turned to LeMaster in the cold wind.
How have you been, Dirk?
Well, I've been better. Think I'm catching a head cold, this damned weather.
Yeah, it's been a rough one, that's for sure. Think we'll ever have another card game like that one on the train? You, Ike, and me?
Sim stepped through the door.
I hope not. I hate being looked at that way by everybody.
Well, maybe next time we'll...
Sim's words stopped short at the sight of C.B. Harrington reaching down and snatching Priest's pistol from his holster.
Oh, no.
J.T. Priest saw his pistol streak up in Harrington's hand.
What the...
You're so worried about this swindler? I'll settle your mind, Priest.
Harrington cocked the pistol and aimed it. Priest only stared in surprise.
No, wait!
Sims and LeMaster both ducked to one side. Second shot went wide as well, slicing across the small door just as Cade McCorkle started to step out with the Derringer in her hand.
No, Cade, get back!
Sims moved toward her, putting her behind him. Sims faltered backward a step.
God, no!
Sims spun around with the impact of the fifth shot, facing Cade on his way to the floor where he fell flat and limp at her feet.
God, no!
Cade Derringer came up, cocked and aimed.
Oh, son of a...
The bullet stung C.B. Harrington's face like a mad hornet before LeMaster could jump forward and wrench the gun from her hand. Within seconds, Louisville Light ran in from the engine, a pistol in his hand.
God almighty!
Ike stooped down, ran a hand beneath Sims's chest, and held it there for a second, ignoring Kate McCorkle's screams. When he stood up, he raised his bloody hand and looked at it.
Charlie Sims is dead. Don't just stand there, help me.
Louisville Light jumped forward and helped hold her back.
Damn it, CD. I didn't think you had it in you.
Beside Priest, the pistol cocked again in Harrington's thick hand.
You have no idea what lengths I'll go to with the sniff of gold, sir. You wanted him dead? There he is. I have one shot left here. Are we gonna talk about that gold or not?
Harrington stood with a white handkerchief pressed to his grazed cheek, dark blood already soaking through it.
Easy, CB. Jesus, sure, we can go get the gold. We can go right now. But how will we settle our deal with Sims dead?
That's something we'll take care of when the time comes. If there's gold, I want it!
No problem at all.
Tell her she's dead too if she keeps fighting us.
Bastard!
Tell her what you want. I don't care what you do to that foul-tempered wretch.
Harrington turned back to Priest.
Where is it?
Huh?
The gold, dammit! Where's the cave? Don't fool with me, Priest. I just killed a man because you said you didn't trust having him along.
Harrington shoved Priest down onto the sofa with the pistol barrel.
Now start talking.
Okay. It's not easy to explain.
Harrington pitched the bloody handkerchief down onto the sofa. He took a pencil and writing pad from inside his coat, and he dropped them in Priest's lap.
There. Draw it out. Surely you can do that, can't you?
Priest took the pencil and pad and started drawing a map. Then he stopped and looked up at Harrington.
Where did you say you ran into Steelhead Radnor?
I didn't say. What of it?
Nothing. You took a big chance, hoping he'd bring you to us. And an even bigger chance coming on your own after losing him on the way. Yeah, I'm starting to think you're not C.B. Harrington the businessman at all.
Are you now?
That's right. I'm thinking you're C.B. Harrington, a cutthroat outlaw. No different than me, Cleveland Phelps, or the others.
C.B. Harrington kept the pistol leveled on Priest as he finished the drawing and held the pad up for him to see.
Too bad we're doing away with the criminal part of this business. You and I could do well for ourselves.
I don't think so.
Harrington snatched the pad from Priest's hand and studied it.
So this is where we're going, eh? This is where the wagons are hidden?
That's the place. We can be there in a day.
You're certain this is the spot?
I know it like the back of my hand. If there's gold in those wagons, we'll be running our fingers through it this time tomorrow.
Lemaster, come here.
Harrington motioned him over from where he stood holding Kate McCorkle. Lemaster passed Kate to Louisville Ike, Kate looking much calmer now.
You're familiar with that country. Think this is the right place?
Hell yeah, it's the right place. Why would I lie about it now? We're on our way there, ain't we?
Yep. I just wanted to make sure.
The master looked up from the pad.
Well, I'm familiar with those buttes there. This map looks real enough. I can't say beyond that.
Of course it's real.
What do you think, Ike?
I have no idea. But I can't see why he'd lie about it now.
Ike turned Kate McCorkle loose and reached out with his boot and nudged the body of Quick Charlie Sims.
Why don't we ask old Charlie here? What do you think, Quick Charlie? This is your show, after all.
Yeah.
But then Priest's expression changed.
Oh, no!
Priest watched Sims' body come back to life as Sims rose stiffly from the floor, the rawhide binding dangling from his freed wrists.
Damn you, Sims!
That's it, fellas. He's telling the truth.
Sims reached a hand out and braced himself as Kate McCorkle flung herself into his arms.
JT never could hold out the long game once things start happening fast.
JT Priest shot forward.
I'll kill you, Sims!
Sims sidestepped and allowed Priest to dart past him, straight into the waiting arms of Louisville Icon LeMaster. They dragged Priest away.
It's quite emotional, too, doesn't he?
In the small village where the drifts of snow rose high up the sides of the teepees and ragged old army tents, old Henri Kettle stood up from the warmth of the glowing fire and stepped over to the fly of the tent. He raised the fly far enough to look out and see Bert Eisen shaking a stick above his head. Then Bert tossed the stick a few yards across the snowy ground. A big yellow dog loped, bouncing high in the snow to its belly to fetch the stick and start the game all over again.
I think Burnt Man will talk someday.
Henri Kettle dropped the flap of the fly and walked back to his pile of rabbit pelts and elk skins near the fire.
We may never know what has passed before his eyes and caused his tongue to go silent. Is it important that we should know?
The two other old Indians looked at one another. Then Red Horse turned to Henri Kettle.
No, if you take him in, he is your son. I will ask no more about him. It is enough that we know he did not kill our brother, Crow Striker.
They were back now in a high rock valley above the mines. Their bellies were full, their old bones were warm, and their voices were less testy with one another. What more was there? Henri Kettle looked at his two friends and almost smiled.
I marvel at how Burnt Man shows no pain. Already he is out in the cold as if nothing happened to him.
He shows pain. We do not see it because we do not yet know where to look. All men show pain. Yet, the greater the pain, the less men show it.
So we know a man is in great pain only when we see no sign of it at all?
Yes, I think that is so. I think Burnt Man has been in such pain that he has forgotten to feel it. He does not know what it is.
You don't know this.
Oh, yes, I know this.
No, you cannot know this. You have not known Burnt Man long enough to
know. I do know this.
You don't.
Yes, I do.
Here we go.
Outside, Bert Eisen bent down in the snow and slipped a knife from his belt. He held the knife behind him, hiding it from the yellow curs that ran up to him and dropped the stick in the snow at his feet.
Good boy. Good boy.
He could hear his words in his head, but he couldn't form them aloud.
Nice dog.
Bert Eisen reached his free arm out and looped it around the dog and pulled it against his chest. He felt the outer cold of the animal's fur, and yet he could feel a warmth beneath that reminded him of something from a long time ago. His free hand encircled the dog's neck, and he felt the beating pulse there, the fast blood racing beneath his fingertips. Behind his back, Bert's hand tightened around the handle of the knife, and his eyes were flat and empty for a moment. The dog rubbed against him, its breath swirling away in a long, cottony steam. And as if seeing something in Bert's hollow eyes, the yellow cur threw open its wet muzzle to the tender flesh on Bert's jaw, where the raging fire had left its mark, and gently licked him there as if knowing of Bert's pain. Bert's hand loosened on the knife handle, and he let it drop to the ground. With both arms around the yellow cur, the dog warm against him, its tongue soothing, Bert Eisen struggled deep inside his chest and his mind, until at length
He turned his face from the animal.
Goodbye.
Then he turned his tired eyes out across the quiet, frozen land, staring in vacant wonder. He had no idea how he'd gotten here, or where he'd been those long times before. As the train rolled on across the blizzard-swept plains toward the Badlands, Kate McCorkle looked around at the smiling faces of Dirk LeMaster, Louisville-like Woodson, and the man she had known as C.B. Harrington.
You mean this has all been one big stage show?
I'm afraid so, Kate. I told you J.T. Priest would never tell me the location of those wagons. This was the only way I knew to get it out of him. The only way to clean up Midwest investment and put an end to Los Pistoleros. Kate, gives me great pleasure to introduce you to Uncle Stanley Check.
Sims gestured a hand toward the man who'd been impersonating C.B. Harrington. Kate blinked a few times, already seeing a difference in the gruff, strong-handed manner of the man she'd known as C.B. Harrington. Now that this man Charlie introduced her to was out of character, there was a friendly, almost jovial aura about him. Uncle Stanley rose halfway from his seat with the handkerchief pressed to his bleeding cheek.
A pleasure indeed, young lady. Please don't take anything I said personally. I really get caught up in any role I play.
Oh, my, no. Here, let me take a look at that wound, you poor dear. I feel just awful doing that to you.
Quick Charlie Sims relaxed and shook his tired head, watching Kate busy herself with Uncle Stanley's face wound. She attended the deep graze along his cheek and bandaged it for him. Uncle Stanley explained to her all the while that he realized how these things could happen in a game this intense.
Charlie told me you had a temper, and it could be hard to handle sometimes. Perhaps we should have let you in on things, but Charlie insisted we play things out as naturally as possible. I'm glad you're not angry.
Kate turned to Quick Charlie Sims with a hand on her hip.
Well, I should be, you scaring me like that. I really thought you were dead when Ike raised his bloody hand from under your chest.
Theatrical makeup. Dirk and I always carry some in our pocket, especially when we work with these two. You never know when you're gonna need to die real quick.
From his spot on the floor at the bar with his hands cuffed around a foot rail, J.T. Priest lay staring daggers at all of them. Kate looked at each of the three men in turn, Louisville Ike, Dirk LeMaster, then Uncle Stanley. Each of them cordially returned her smile.
But how could you have possibly had everything planned to go the way it did?
We didn't. You can never run something this widespread by the numbers and expect everything to fall into place. But everybody knew their role and played things accordingly. Sort of like starting out in a game of chess.
As Sim spoke, a coin appeared in his hand as if out of nowhere. He rolled it back and forth across his knuckles.
You don't know what to expect entirely. But as long as you know how all the pieces should move, you anticipate. Play the game out.
So that's what we were doing. I was starting to wonder. We played a lot by ear on this one because of the weather. But we got lucky, I suppose.
Lucky? Don't get modest on us, Uncle Stanley. There are few people who can work this way. These three gentlemen just happen to be the best at it in the world, for my money. Uncle Stanley sets things up. Got Steelhead Radner to go along with him just to make sure Los Pistoleros would hear him out. Ike and Dirk here played the go-betweens. Their jobs were to create a diversion, first by the card game incident, then by keeping Radner busy goading him on. Nobody ever stopped to think that this could all be a scheme. Phelps and Priest just turned their stock over to the all-powerful C.B. Harrington without question.
Sims grinned, tipping a salute to Ike and LeMaster.
They did well, these two. They would have also been safety men working as backup in case something went wrong.
Yes, and a lot of things did.
It got a little too close for comfort a couple of times, I have to admit. I'm just glad I never had to sign anything into C.B. Harrington's name. That would have been more problems to deal with. This way, it's all clean and simple.
Yep, you sure pulled it off. We set out to bust up Los Pistoleros' financial holding, and we did. I wanted to know where my family's wagons were hidden, and now I know. At long last, my family can rest in peace.
What about those two federal deputies? Are they going to understand what's going on? I don't want them down on me for any reason.
Hart and Roth? They're the best in the business. By the time they reach Fort Smith, I'll have Judge Parker filled in on everything. We work together well, me and those two. They just don't always realize it. But by now, they're starting to know it.
But wasn't it awfully risky? I mean, Uncle Stanley shooting at you that way?
That had me worried. Uncle Stanley switched blanks into Priest's pistol when he held it behind his back last night. When I saw Priest replace those two blanks he'd fired at the rail yard attendant with real bullets, I got a little tense. But I always get tense when there's guns involved. That's why I avoid them. Look what could have happened had your shot bent just a couple of inches to the right.
I know. But I had to do something. I thought he'd killed you.
I know, Kate. There's times when nothing comes in as handy as a loaded pistol. Problem is knowing when that time is at hand. Most times a pistol is simply the quick cure. I like to think there's always a better way if a person has time to look for it.
Well, I just thank God you're okay. All of us, for that matter. You got what you wanted. The deputies will get what they wanted once Priest is back in his cell.
Kate paused and looked at Uncle Stanley.
What about you? What do you get out of this?
They were my people, too. The ones who were murdered and left in the caves. All Roma gypsies are of the same family. Of course, owning the largest part of Midwest Investment Corporations is not a bad reward, either.
Uncle Stanley patted his coat pocket, where the stock ownership papers lay signed and ready for recorded transfer into his name.
We'll have to ditch this big Pullman car pretty soon. Evidently, C.B. Harrington is looking all over the country for it.
Yes, I know. Too bad, though. I could really get used to traveling this way.
Well, with the money the family will be making from the investment stock, you can soon afford one of your own.
But it won't be the same. There's something appealing about traveling freely on a Pullman car that doesn't belong to me. But, to be honest, this will never replace the Roma wagons.
No, sir. Never.
Sim smiled and turned to Kate McCorkle.
See? I told you I might have a gang of my own.
If you gentlemen will excuse us, I have some things I want to discuss with Charlie in private.
We understand.
Louisville-like and Dirk LeMaster stepped aside to let Kate lead Quick Charlie Sims toward the bedroom door. Uncle Stanley looked up at Ike and LeMaster.
That's Charlie. If this and this alone is all a man is doing life, what a lucky man he is, eh?
Yeah. You should have seen her face when I leaned in and told her Sims was alive. That this was all being staged so the priest would tell us where the wagons are.
Yes. It makes us realize there are far more precious things than wealth, doesn't it?
Yes, that's true. There's far more than wealth. Hey, hold on. Shouldn't we sit down and decide how we're going to divide the shares in Midwest Investment?
Of course. We can do that now.
Okay. Don't start trying to soften us up with all this flowery, more important than wealth malarkey.
Oh, that's not what I was doing. You know we always share and share alike. Now then, let's divide things up. Maybe have time to play some poker on our way to the Badlands, eh?
Don't even think about it, Stanley.
Louisville Ike pulled up a chair and sat down, fingering the deck of cards on the table.
I'm not about to gamble my shares away. Are you, Dirk?
No, but... Well, I suppose we could play a few hands, though, just to pass the time.
Sure, why not?
Uncle Stanley picked up the deck, riffled the cards, fanned them, spread them out across the felt, then brought them back into a neat stack, all in one dazzling sweep of his hand.
Oh, that Quick Charlie, I swear. I don't know where he gets it from.
Thank you.
The Dead or Alive trilogy continues with Book 3, Blood Money. Dead or Alive Book 2, Devil's Due, is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2001 by Ralph Cotton. Published by arrangement with Ralph Cotton. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2012, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Mort Shelby, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, Timothy Lynch, Barbara Pinellini, Patrick Bussink, Tim Carlin, Alyssa Wilman, Thomas Keegan, Jeff Allen, James Lewis, Lily Beacon, Gregory Gorton, Thomas Penny, Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, Joel David Santner, James Konacek, Alexander Strain, David Coyne, Michael John Casey, Johan Detweiler, Scott McCormick, Gary Tells, Daniel Sontag, Drew Copus, Nick DePinto, Tracy Oliveira. Directed by Ken Jackson. Book adapted for Graphic Audio by Johan Detweiler. Dialogue editing and Graphic Audio sound design by Sam Grabenti. Original music by Johan Detweiler, Brian Patton, and Nathaniel Perry. Theme music by Temeskin Whoopi. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cuddy, Mary Cuddy, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Dead or Alive, be sure to look for the series Cotton Pickings, as well as the Great American Westerns series, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pumped titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other Graphic Audio thrillers.
Available now in Graphic Audio.
In the cellars of the Wine God lies a key without a lock.
It's a puzzle box. In order to open it, you have to follow a certain sequence of motions.
And how do you know that you are on the right path?
You don't.
Ah, so the box mirrors life, no?
I suppose it does, but that doesn't help tell me how to get it open.
Doug Morrell's office.
Hi, Doug. It's Anya. I'm helping the French police with an investigation in the catacombs.
What? In the catacombs? You're running an investigation in the catacombs and you didn't tell me? I'll send a crew over immediately.
There's nothing here of interest to the show. The authorities stumbled on the skeleton of a man in a Civil War uniform and...
Union or Confederate uniform?
Confederate. But that's really beside the point.
This is good, Anya. Real good. We can turn this into a world-class episode. Just leave it to me.
Doug, we're not doing an episode on this. I just need the letter authenticated.
Who's it from?
Jefferson Davis.
Confederate President Jefferson Davis?
The one and the same.
Anya?
Yes, Doug?
Let me be sure I've got this straight. You discovered a skeleton, dressed in the uniform of a Confederate soldier, carrying a letter from President Davis in the midst of the Paris catacombs, and you don't think there's anything of interest there for the show.
There you'll find the lady, left alone and in distress.
The Creed woman apparently survived the fall from the roof. She needs to be eliminated before she speaks to the police. Get back up there and get rid of her before she becomes more of a nuisance.
How did you get that?
I'd be happy to explain everything, but right now I think it's better if we got out of here, don't you? Run!
To find that which you are seeking, use the key to unlock the chest.
It would seem, Miss Creed, that you are better prepared to find the treasure than your colleague. I think it would be much better if you did the dirty work, found the treasure, and then just turned it over to me.
Like hell I will.
Kill one of them. I don't care which one.
Wait! Just wait a moment. I'm sure we can work this out.
Work this out? What is there to work out? You'll either find the treasure for me or I'll shoot your friends. It's pretty simple.
Fine. I'll do it.
See? That wasn't so difficult now, was it? What are you waiting for? I told you to kill one of them.
You son of a bitch!
Anya!
Rogue Angel number 33, Cradle of Solitude.
Available now in graphic audio.
Kiss! Kiss, my darling! Come inside!
I remember some things. Others, not so much. And some things I only remember too late.
Graphic Audio presents Lilith St. Crow's Jill Kismet.
I'm for sale, Pericles. Bid high.
Book 6, Angel Town.
Go to Hyperion. You can be our avenging hand.
What do you remember?
Saul, is he all right? I'm afraid either way, Davy.
My children! Now is the hour of our glory!
Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.